Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast.
Time for another science show on your ABC Radio National. And today, eating our national icon, the roo. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. Did you know that agriculture accounts for about a third of emissions, but is nonetheless left out of most of the schemes? Is this wise? Elise Mole reports.
The biggest sector of agricultural emissions is livestock and the gases produced from both ends of cattle as they digest their feed.
Globally, the livestock industry at large, and particularly beef cattle industry, has a major impact on the world's environment.
Professor Tony McMichael from the Australian National University.
The UN's Food and Agricultural Organization produced a report in 2006 called Livestock's Long Shadow. And they're making the argument that the impact of intensive forms of beef production around the world is affecting freshwater supplies, affecting the use and the sustainability of land, and of course is contributing to climate change via the energy that goes into the sector, and in particular the methane gas that is produced by cattle as ruminant animals in the course of fermentation of their diet. And already, livestock production around the world is doing a lot of damage to local environments and accounts for about one-fifth of the world's greenhouse gas emissions when you look at that sector as a whole. So it's a major environmental problem that is already pushing us beyond sustainable limits.
Farmers have always had to cope with climate variability, as Katrina Sinclair, research agronomist with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, explains.
Over the last 10 years, there's been an increase in the amount of fodder that they're storing as a risk management strategy because they've been exposed to these very dry years in a row. They've experienced some bad years, and we've got farmers here that have already storing more fodder. They've been starting to grow more prairie grass, increasing the acreage. So farmers are making changes. And it doesn't strictly sit under the banner of climate change. It's in response to how the seasons have been.
With a reprieve from the drought in sight, the Australian cattle herd is projected to rebuild over the next few years, which means livestock emissions will increase. The Department of Climate Change estimates the number of grass-fed beef cattle in Australia will reach 28.7 million head by 2020, the highest it's ever been. Professor Tony McMichael says the current level of meat consumption is unsustainable.
The world is on a trajectory at the moment for levels of meat consumption that is simply not sustainable with current methods of production. And indeed, the G8 meeting has very recently said that in order to meet demand, it's likely that meat production would have to increase by 80% by the year 2030. Well, frankly, that's not sustainable. And I think environmental scientists and the Food and Agricultural Organization recognize this. The other thing that can be done, of course, is to radically change some of the production methods for producing ruminant animals, cattle and sheep, for example. And third, we could actually switch our meat preferences to other types of animals. And in Australia, that would include eating an increasing proportion of kangaroo meat.
How is the consumption of kangaroo better for the environment?
First, it's basically a healthier meat. Human bodies are well attuned to consuming lean game meat. We've evolved to eat it over 2 million years. It has a much lower content of saturated fat. Much more of what we call fish oils, the unsaturated omega-3 fatty acids that are actually good for us. Second, the kangaroos are not ruminants. They don't ferment their food in the way that cattle and sheep do, and they don't produce the vast amounts of methane gas, which is such a potent greenhouse gas, many times more potent than carbon dioxide. And third, of course, they tread much more lightly on the Australian environment. They're not cloven-hoofed animals, and they don't damage our topsoils.
However, as population growth steadily increases, Tony McMichael says the global demand for meat and dairy products is set to have a major impact on the environment.
We have a serious problem arising in the world with respect to the levels of meat consumption in a world that is becoming increasingly overpopulated. At the moment, the international average is of the order of 100 grams of meat a day. In America, it's over 300. In Africa, it's less than 30. Now, if we were to have a population of 9 billion by the year 2050, and we were to have huge developing countries like China, India, Brazil, Mexico, all intending to eat meat at that sort of level, the amount of meat we would have to produce in the world would be extraordinarily greater than today, more than double.
Dr. Van Zweeten says the agriculture sector will need to adopt new farming methods to cope with climate change as the demand for food increases.
Farming will have to do better than what it is at the moment because human population is increasing, we all need to eat, and the demand for food globally is certainly increasing, so we just need to look at ways of doing things better. And new farming methods are always being developed. We've got lots of people on the ground, you know, doing research, working with farmers to try and improve the system.
Cattle are just part of the problem. The use of fertiliser in crop production is also a major contributor to harmful emissions. Research conducted by Lucas Van Zweeten and his team has led to a pasture improvement product known as biochar, made from plant and animal waste. The process also creates a source of renewable energy.
Conversion from tilled cropping systems through to pasture has been established to increase carbon content in soil, thereby sequestering carbon. Our particular angle is conversion of the labile carbons in the forms of animal manures or in the forms of plant material such as cellulose and lignin into more permanent forms of carbon. We call it biochar. And in that whole process, we're converting some of that carbon into energy, so electricity, and also into a very stable form of carbon, which should be able to be traded on the carbon market.
This technology could harness 7 million tonnes of bio-waste that exists in New South Wales alone.
Wastes that are currently going to landfill include things like biosolids, include green wastes, include domestic wastes such as paper and food scraps, byproduct forestry residue, we've got animal feedlot manures, we've got paper mill wastes, just to name a few. We've got wastes from the macadamia industry, we've got wastes from the rice industry. All sorts of agricultural and urban wastes can potentially be put through the pyrolysis unit, which converts those biomasses into electricity through the conversion of the biomass into flammable gas, which can get turned into electricity, and also biochar.
Emissions from landfill account for 13% of global greenhouse gases. It's the second largest source of methane after emissions from cows. While researchers are still working on methods to reduce methane emissions from cattle, the technology to reduce methane from landfill already exists.
Well, the technology is ready to go now. I guess we're just in the final stages of proving the methodology up. We've recently commenced a scoping study for the north coast of New South Wales to have a look at the volume of biomass that's available for slow pyrolysis in the region. We're looking at the price of electricity. We're looking at the potential price that we might get for the biochar. So once all of these figures start aligning, business will come in and will start dictating the implementation of these new technologies.
Lucas Van Zweeten, Senior Research Scientist at the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries. And that report by Elise Mole. Well, this week a paper was published by Dr. George Wilson of Australian Wildlife Services in Canberra on just how much carbon can be saved if we do switch from cattle and sheep to our other icon, the kangaroo. He says we could save 16 megatons if we change how we farm.
We're saying that if one were to manage kangaroo populations upwards and manage cattle down, then you can make a substantial saving in Australia's greenhouse gas debit and potentially save the livestock industries from having to pay for permits under an emissions trading scheme. You can produce the same amount of meat and do so in a far more environmentally friendly way.
You suggest that the cattle produce about 3% of Australia's greenhouse gases. That's more or less the same as planes, isn't it?
Well, in fact, cattle themselves produce more than that. We're focusing on the Australian rangelands, the areas in which the existing kangaroo industry operates at the moment, and we're saying in those lands there are about 7 million cattle and about 30-odd million sheep. And if we were to exchange those for kangaroos, then you'd save 3%. We're not suggesting that we need to replace dairy cows with kangaroos, because quite clearly that's not going to work. We're focused on the rangelands, and in those areas, by making greater use of kangaroos, where the kangaroo industry already exists, you can save 3% of Australia's greenhouse gas liability.
How did you work that out?
Well, we looked at the amount of methane they produced, and we calculated that up. We also looked at the dry sheep equivalents that cattle are and sheep are on the rangelands, and we said if you remove those dry sheep equivalents, and we know what the equivalent of a kangaroo is, if you were to replace that with kangaroos, we used a very conservative figure, a much lower one than is generally accepted. Because if you took the higher figure, we could probably carry 250 million kangaroos. We're suggesting that in these lands, to be conservative, if you let the population rise by the year 2020 to 175 million, then you can produce the same amount of meat and you can make all those greenhouse gas savings that we talked about.
Why don't the kangaroos produce methane then?
Well, they have different flora in their guts. Basically, they operate on a different system. They have a pseudo-rumen and it operates with different flora. Cattle have a full rumen, and the flora that they have, the microorganisms, when it's digesting the cellulose and lignin, it produces methane. And of course, methane is a very dangerous greenhouse gas. It's much more potent than CO2. But happily, it only stays in the environment for a shorter period of time. So steps that can be taken to produce methane are a much more effective way of addressing greenhouse gas problems than focusing on carbon dioxide.
Which kangaroos are we talking about? Because there are so many, over 50 different species. How would you make sure that people sorted out the right ones to use and not knock off the yellow-footed rock wallaby?
Well, indeed. And what we're talking about is the area where the existing kangaroo industry operates at the moment. And, of course, it's focused on those extremely abundant species which occur on private property. We're talking about red kangaroos, eastern grey kangaroos, western grey kangaroos and euros. And the Department of Environment estimates that there's about 30-odd million of these animals out there already. So part of this project is about bringing that to book, letting the landholders on whose properties these animals already occur become involved, grow the industry, and at the same time give them an alternative, because they really don't have many alternatives to address the greenhouse gas issue. There's been quite a bit of work done over the years to try and put kangaroo ruminal flora into cattle, but it just doesn't work. The physical structure of the kangaroo's gut system is so different from a cattle that you can't just replace the organisms and expect that you will begin to make a rumen not produce methane.
Have you talked to any of the farmers, graziers, about how much easier it might be to have kangaroos culled instead of cattle and how they might do it on a sustainable and indeed practical basis?
Well, what we're doing here is building on overseas experiences. In southern Africa and in Scotland and indeed in North America, iconic wildlife has been brought into the production system so that in southern Africa, the South Africans use springbok, another iconic species. In Scotland, they use red deer, and in North America, bison. Now, these animals, particularly the first two, do roam from property to property just as kangaroos do, and yet they've been able to develop a regional management process so that all of the landholders in an area that have these animals on their lands are able to benefit from them. Now, we've had some trials going in central Queensland and in western New South Wales now for a few years to look at this as an issue, because we think it is an important long-term issue, that kangaroos really do need to be regarded as part of the main land use and not as pests. In the long term, it's not a good position for kangaroos to be in. They need to be part of the system. So what we've done with this study is go on from that generalised observation and say, look, here's another reason, a really strong reason why kangaroos should be part of the production system, why landholders should have a reason for wanting to have them on their properties. And at the same time, there are a whole lot of other conservation benefits that flow from this.
Yes, one of them being the fact that cattle are very expensive in terms of water, in terms of energy, in terms of just sheer space, 10 times the non-cattle alternative of growing crops. Has that influenced farmers at all so far?
Well, yes, we do have landholders that are sympathetic to those observations. It's another step, the one that we're proposing in this paper, to go on from there and say, OK, that basic premise is accepted, but how about going the next step and beginning to regard the kangaroo as their resource rather than the cattle?
Yeah, I'm not talking about being sympathetic so much as being just hard-nosed and practical. If it's going to cost them 10 times less in those general expenditures, then surely they'll leap for it, because things are tough for farmers these days.
This is right. And harvesting a free-ranging animal in the field that doesn't have any of those management inputs, there's no crutching, there's no castrations, there's no all the other activities that conventional beef operations are required. These animals are so successful, they are out there, they breed like mad, nobody does anything, they become a pest, they're so successful. Surely it's time in Australia that we began to regard this as a resource that should be part of the main production system. So we do have landholders who are coming round to that perspective, and they're the ones that we've been working with in the rangelands in Western Queensland.
How might the kangaroos themselves be affected by climate change, do you think?
Well, it'll be at both ends. As the country becomes more arid, then we anticipate that some areas, particularly in Western New South Wales, that are currently in farming and maybe even irrigation, may go out of those land uses and they may go back to being rangelands again, as indeed they were before. A lot of the irrigation areas in Western New South Wales and Northern Queensland are in areas that used to be rangelands. So it could be that the kangaroo populations in those areas would increase and that you would be able to harvest kangaroos from areas that had previously been used for these other land uses. At the other extreme, then maybe as land becomes more arid under the effects of climate change, then the range of the kangaroo may contract. But under our proposal, if you remove all of those dry sheep equivalents off these rangelands, then you create the opportunity for a much larger population to be supported.
Now, of course, we eat Bambi and we eat Larry the Lamb and even Jack Rabbit, but what do you say to people who look askance at you and say, you really want me to eat Skippy? What do you tell them?
Well, I say to them that South Africans are not so put off by eating springbok. I worked in Scotland for a number of years, and red deer, an equally iconic animal to the Scots, is on the menu there. The French have been known to eat the odd chicken or rooster. Similarly, in North America, bison are a very iconic animal. I noticed the other night that they're on the badge of the Department of the Interior. And yet, under the sorts of proposals that we're talking about here, private ownership and management has actually increased the number of bison in North America many, many fold. So I believe it's possible with those examples to be able to have your iconic animal, to still love it, but it needn't necessarily stop you eating it. After all, kangaroos were a very important part of the diet of Aborigines for many, many, many millennia, and of course they had iconic status with them.
How is it different from eating whales?
I think it's all about how these animals are killed. I think that's the really important issue. And in fact, this is yet another area where I think kangaroo use is important. A headshot in the field at night, I believe, is much less of an animal welfare issue than all of the things that the beef industry subjects cattle to. In other words, moving animals, transport's a major animal welfare issue. The slaughtering of cattle is an issue. There are a whole suite of issues. And I believe the animal welfare issues associated with using kangaroos are far less. These are the issues. If one is not a vegetarian, and I respect people who wish to be vegetarians, of course, but if you're not a vegetarian, then it really comes down to the way these species are killed and how humanely it's done. And I'm a very strong supporter of humane treatment of animals.
Well, that was Dr. George Wilson, whose report came out on Thursday. He's director of Australian Wildlife Services in Canberra, trained as a vet and worked with kangaroos for many years. And the bird life in his garden, I can tell you, is spectacular. King parrots, rosellas and gangangs. Someone clearly close to animals, as he said. Production today by protected icons David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.